Tonight we're going to be looking at the topic of origins, evolution, or creation. I am going to be making some references to particular scriptures during this message, but this isn't going to be a typical Bible study, just simply because of the topic that we're going to be covering. Let me begin, though, by taking us a little bit back. Prior to the 20th century, the biblical account of how we came to be was far and wide taught in the American public school system. It's what was believed by the vast majority of American citizens. And so the kids in our country were educated that the Bible tells us how we came to be, that our lives were created by God, that our lives have purpose because God created our lives with purpose. But it was about the middle of the 1800s, 1859 in particular, that Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species came out. And it began to make waves. The reason that it did is because he began to theorize that life did not come through divine means, but by natural means. That higher life forms have essentially evolved from lower life forms, and that all of life basically can be traced back to a common ancestor. Now, there were many people at that time that believed that Darwin's ideas were actually very credible. But again, there were many others that were extremely resistant because, by and large, America was a Christian country, and the Bible was what was believed, and the biblical account of how we came to be is what was believed. And so Darwinian evolution was, for a very long time, shunned by many Americans, though there were some that began to listen. Now, fast forward to 1925, and in the state of Tennessee, the Scopes trial, or what was known as the Monkey Scopes trial, took place as the state of Tennessee decided to sue a substitute teacher by the name of John Scopes, who apparently had begun to teach the evolutionary theory in the public school there in Tennessee. And at that time, that was an illegal thing to do. Creationism was to be taught. Evolution was illegal to teach. Now, this trial gained nationwide attention. Everybody focused on this trial in Tennessee. They wanted to know how this was going to play out. Now, there are many that believe that the whole thing was just a publicity stunt, that actually it was kind of a staged thing where Tennessee simply wanted to establish that they were a state that was going to believe in creationism and not evolution. And so the whole trial itself, some believe, is that it was staged so that Tennessee could basically make a point. But regardless, Tennessee, or the court system, I should say, deemed that John Scopes was guilty of teaching what was not legal to teach in Tennessee. And the Scopes trial essentially stated that Darwinism evolution was not welcome in the state of Tennessee, and other states followed suit. Now, 100 years, and we bring ourselves to today. And in the past 100 years, we can say definitely that things have changed drastically. Today, it is creationism that is stifled, and naturalism is what is reigning. It is the evolutionary theory that began primarily with Charles Darwin that is the dominant view. In fact, creationism is seen as solely a religious belief and a blind belief at best, meaning that it has no evidence really to support it other than the Bible says so. Whereas evolution is seen as the truth that is supported by science. And today it is often seen not as a theory, but as a fact, because they say all the evidence supports it. And then we find ourselves, the Christians, in 2019, kind of caught in the middle. because we have been going to church that teaches us that God created the heavens and the earth and all that is in them. But then we go to our schools and we're taught that the natural world is all that there is, and everything that came to be by very natural happenings rather than divine intervention. This has so penetrated the church that many in your generation, a Barna poll found out, have actually begun to believe that Christianity is out of touch. 29% of people your age right now feel that the churches today are out of step with the scientific world. 25% believe that Christianity is essentially anti-science in their stance. And 23% have been turned off by the creation-evolution debate. In fact, there are many of your generation that have departed from the church, at least in part because they see an extreme conflict between what they have been taught in their science classes and what they have been taught in their Sunday school classes. In fact, there are many young people like yourselves that maybe have chosen a profession that is within the scientific realm and are now having a real hard time trying to reconcile what your faith is and what your profession is. I've known many Christians that have been in the public school system and many that have chosen occupations within the scientific community that have really had to wrestle through these things. Are the things that I have been taught in church the truth, or are the things that I have been taught in my schooling actually the truth? I want to tell you a story about a guy by the name of Douglas Axe who has actually come out with a book called Undeniable, in which he basically is showing that the evidence within creation or life is undeniable that it was designed. We're going to talk about that a little bit more here, but in his book Undeniable, he shares the story about when he was a grad student. He was at one time in one of his science classes given an exam, and several of the questions on the exam not only were about evolution, but came from the vantage point that they were assuming that life did evolve. And so one question in particular was essentially asking, how did life first appear? Well, he knew the answer that the professor was looking for, but he also had serious problems with that answer, and he believed that it was not a foolproof answer. He thought that there were serious, if not fatal, flaws in the correct answer that the professor was looking for. So he was in this dilemma. Do I give the professor what he wants to hear, or do I answer this question in the way that I believe is right? I know many of you have probably faced similar things when you've had to take a test or respond to a question in one of your science courses. Do I give the answer that I know that they are looking for, or do I give the answer that actually I believe is the truth? Well, here was Douglas Axe in the middle of that dilemma. What do I do? Well, what he did decide to do is this. He decided that he was going to give the answer that the professor was looking for so that he would get the points on the test. But he would, as extra credit, after he gave his answer, he would give the reasons why he thought that this answer actually had serious problems. When he got his test back, he was marked down for his answer to this question. This was his response in the book. He said, I learned that we students were expected not only to know current thinking in biology, but also to accept it without resistance. We were there as much to be acculturated, or that means assimilated, as educated. I had learned my lesson. The stream of scientific consensus flows with an almost irresistible current. In other words, he learned as a student at that time that his belief was up against the current of scientific consensus, and that he better fall in line or he is going to face resistance, as he did on that test. Which brings us really to the question that we all need to ask: are we expected to believe what we are told without questioning it? I would say this, that if something is true, if something is absolutely true, it will stand underneath scrutiny. And that does not only go for science and evolution, but also for our Christian faith as well. All of us ought to want to know what the truth actually is. And if we are seriously seeking the truth, we should not be afraid to test what we have been told and scrutinize those things, because if it is actually true, it will stand. There are many directions I wrestled with going in regards to this topic. We're talking about a very vast topic and something that has been wrestled with for a very, very long time. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of books that are out there on both sides of the argument. And so the amount of material that I could have gone through, or the direction that I could have taken in tackling this topic, could have gone a lot of ways. I could have decided that I was going to critique Darwinian evolution and take a look at the fossil record to show that what we have actually found in the 100-plus years since Darwin is that it does not match what his theory stated back when he wrote Origin of the Species. Instead, what it actually shows us, in particular in the fossil record, the Cambrian explosion, which gives evidence that most life forms as we know them appeared suddenly and fully formed and did not necessarily evolve over a long period of time. I could have gone in that direction, or I could have decided that I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the merits of the biblical account. Talk about Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 2, and other portions of Scripture that would be relevant to the topic. And talk about why Adam and Eve were literal and not just an allegorical story that was written long, long ago. Could have delved into the many different interpretations that have come out about Genesis chapter 1, like, are they literal days? Does the day-age theory have any reason to be adhered to? What about the gap theory or theistic evolution? There are a lot of things that we could have covered. We just simply don't have enough time to go through all of those things. And so I decided what would be maybe most important to understand. And rather than to tackle some of these that I would say are the peripheral questions, I want to go to a targeted question, an overarching question that I think we really need to grapple with, and that is this: does the evidence point to natural evolution or divine creation? And to answer that question, we are going to look at four core questions. Those questions are: how did the universe get here? The second question: why does the universe appear to have so much design? The third: how did life first appear? And fourth: why does life have so much design? And we're going to try and tackle these one at a time, and I'm going to explain a little bit why I think that these are the fundamental questions that ought to be asked. Before we talk about the fossil record, before we talk about Darwin's theory or natural selection or survival of the fittest, or Piltdown Man, or any of the other, hominids that we could talk about, we need to ask these four questions. How did the universe get here? Why does it have so much design in it? How did life get here? Why does it have so much design in it? So one at a time, we're going to tackle these. The first being this: how did the universe get here? Now, obviously, we know the universe exists. We live in it. We can go outside right now, we could look at the cosmos, we could see the stars. During the day, we could see the sun, maybe see the moon. We know through telescopes, you know, how vast the universe is, and scientific study has told us even more than that. But what we know is this, is that the universe is here. So we have to ask the question, how did the universe get here? Really, there are two possibilities. One is that the universe is eternal, which would mean that it has always been here. There's never been a time that the universe was not here. Or that it was brought into existence by something that is eternal. Either way, you have to have something that is eternal. Either the universe is eternal, or something that brought the universe into existence is the thing that is eternal. Why are those the only two options? Because if there was a point where there was absolutely nothing, then there would be always absolutely nothing. Because nothing can't bring anything into existence. One of the things we are going to be looking at tonight, I should say, is this. Is there are things that science has been able to determine. Science can't determine everything, and we shouldn't look to science for every answer. We also need to use our brains to think logically and think reasonably. So science helps, but so does logic and reason. And at this particular point, we need to use our logic and our reason. If there was a point in time, and I use time loosely because time also came into existence, that there was nothing, then there would always be nothing, because nothing can't bring something into existence. So if originally there was absolutely nothing, there would have always been nothing. That tells us this, is that something has to be eternal. Something has always been here. Now, for a long time, it was believed that it was the universe had always been here. Many believed that those that did not believe in God believed that it was the universe itself that was eternal. The universe has always been here. There's never been a time that the universe was not here. And so we believe that the universe is eternal. But since then, science has determined that the universe is not eternal, that it actually came into being at a specific point in time. That's what is referred to as the Big Bang. The Big Bang is determined to be the point in time when the universe came into existence. Now, how do we know that the universe is not eternal, but that it is actually something that came into existence? There are actually several different reasons. I'm going to give you just four of those, but there are more. But I'll rattle these off fairly quickly. One is Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. When Albert Einstein came out with his theory of relativity, it essentially revealed that the universe had a beginning. Now, interestingly enough, Einstein didn't like that what he found out was that the universe had a beginning, and so he actually introduced a fudge factor into his theory that allowed for an eternal universe. I say fudge factor because what he did is he manipulated his numbers in order to come up with a result that would allow for an eternal universe. Later, though, some mathematicians determined that he had made a miscalculation. They had found his fudge factor, and Einstein would later call it the greatest blunder of his life. He later had to acknowledge the fact that the universe is not eternal, but he's not the only one that was able to find that out. Second reason why we know that the universe is not eternal is the radiation echo. Now, this was found back in 1965 by Bell Labs when they determined that the heat afterglow from the Big Bang shows that the universe exploded into existence. So the radiation echo showed that there was a point in time that the universe began. Third, the universe we know today is expanding. The Hubble Space Telescope has revealed this to us as it was launched, I think, back in 1990 or 1991. It's found out many things and discovered many things that we previously did not know, but one of those things it confirmed is the fact that the universe is expanding. Lastly, the final thing I'll share with you about this is that galaxy seeds, is what they call them, of the Big Bang have been found. What that essentially means is that they have found temperature ripples that exist in space. And what these ripples do is enable matter to collect into galaxies. In other words, without these temperature ripples, galaxies would never have been able to form. But because they have found these ripples and have realized that galaxies are actually the result of these ripples, NASA has determined that these testify that the universe had a beginning. In fact, when they found this out back in 1989 by the Cosmic Background Explorer, one of NASA's officials was quoted saying this: "If you're religious, this is like looking at God." In other words, what they had just found was so substantial that he equated it to like looking at the face of God. I want to share with you what some scientists have told us in regards to this. One being Stephen Hawking, who is one of the greatest scientists that the world has ever known, a theoretical physicist who recently passed away. But he said this, he said, "Almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang." Alexander Vilenkin, he was also a physicist and cosmologist, said this: "With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is now no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning." Now, what this does is create a big problem for evolutionists and those who believe that the universe came about by natural means. Because if something came into being, then something had to bring it into being, because something can't come from nothing. I hope you're following that. But essentially what it's saying is this, is that the universe, if it exists, and we know that it is not eternal, then something had to bring the universe into existence. Because if nothing existed before the universe would have never come to be. Not only that, but science now tells us that time, space, and matter all came into existence simultaneously. It's not just that the universe came into existence at one point in time. It's that time itself and space and the matter that makes up the universe all came into existence at the exact same point. Interesting, because Genesis 1:1 tells us exactly that. "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Let me read that again. "In the beginning," that is time, "God created the heavens," that is space, "and the earth," that is matter. Science now tells us that time, space, and matter all came into existence at one point in time. Well, that's what the Bible tells us. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What it also means is that the creator of the universe is outside of time, space, and matter. Because if God was within time, made of matter, he could not create those things. They would have already existed. So God has to be outside of the very things that he had made. That's exactly what the Bible tells us as well, because the Bible tells us that God is eternal, which means that he is outside of time. The Bible also tells us that God is transcendent, which means he's beyond his creation or he's beyond space. It also tells us that God is spirit, which means he is outside of matter. He is not made of material things. So when the Bible tells us that God created the heavens and the earth, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, he is telling us that there was a point in time that God brought into existence time, space, and matter, and that God himself is outside of time, space, and matter. So if the universe is not eternal, then what brought the universe into existence must be. And that's what the Bible teaches us. Now that brings us to the second question. How do we explain a universe that appears to be designed? You see, if the universe came into being by itself through natural causes, then it's essentially an accidental universe. There isn't any mind or intelligence or power behind it, which means that it would result in basically a random universe that has no purpose, no design, no meaning, because it all basically just happened. Let me explain it this way by a few pictures that I think will make this a little bit more understandable to you, because this is where our minds can comprehend and reason and use our own logic that we have to understand the concept that I'm trying to get across. If you and I happen to be out at the sand dunes, we could look at the sand dunes and notice that, you know, there's ripples in the sand. We can see that some of the sand is piling up into hills or mountains and creating valleys within the sand dunes. We might also notice while we're out there that the wind is blowing and the wind is actually causing those grains of sand to blow across the surface, and we could probably deduce from that these sand dunes basically were created very naturally. The ripples are simply a result of the wind blowing across the surface of the sand, that the high points and the low points were probably just the same phenomena of wind or rain or storms blowing through that would cause some of the sand to rise up higher, others to descend a little bit lower. And we could say, you know what, that happened naturally. But then look at this picture of a sand sculpture. Okay? That's made of sand as well. But nobody in their right mind is going to look at that sand sculpture and say, look what the wind did. Because we, in our rational minds, know that wind can create ripples and maybe create sand mountains or sand valleys, but it is not going to create a sand sculpture. That takes intelligence. That takes a mind behind it that thought it up and then brought it into existence. Let me show you another example. We could go to the Grand Canyon. I'm sure many of you guys have been to the Grand Canyon before. We can look at the edge of the Grand Canyon, look down in that canyon, maybe even see the Colorado River flowing at the bottom of that canyon. And we can begin to determine, you know what? I bet you that it was weather patterns that actually made this happen. That over years, that erosion took place. Maybe this river flowing through the center of this valley was instrumental in making this erosion happen, but over time, a canyon was carved due to very natural processes. Wind, rain, erosion, river, that can make that happen. That makes sense to our mind. But then what if you came to Mount Rushmore? I don't know if any of you have visited Mount Rushmore. I went there several years ago to take a look at it firsthand. But this is on the side of a mountain in a forested area. Now, nobody in their right mind is going to stumble along Mount Rushmore and take a look at that mountain and go, my goodness, look what happened over years of lightning strikes and weather patterns and wind and erosion and maybe some squirrels up there burrowing in the rock. They have now created a mountainside that kind of looks like four of our U.S. presidents. I see George Washington. I see Thomas Jefferson. I see Theodore Roosevelt. I see Abraham Lincoln. You see, our minds are able to look at the Grand Canyon and say, okay, I can understand this happening naturally. We cannot look at Mount Rushmore and say that happened just by chance. Our minds can grasp the fact that it took intelligence It took design. It took planning to actually make something like Mount Rushmore happen. Guys, the universe itself shows us the evidence of absolute design. Not something that can just simply happen naturally, but something that had a mind and intelligence behind it. Let me walk you through some statistics. First, beginning with just the universe itself. The universe is expanding at a very precise rate. We're told that if the universe was expanding any faster, that gravity would not have been strong enough for galaxies to form, and without galaxies, no life would be possible. But if it had expanded any slower, then gravity would have collapsed the universe before any stars would have been able to form. This caused Stephen Hawking, the theoretical physicist, to say this: if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in 1,000,000,000,000 a second after the Big Bang, the universe would have collapsed back on itself or never developed galaxies. Now let's take a look at our solar system for a second. Without a just right star in a just right solar system located in a just right galaxy, no life would be possible. If the sun were any bigger than it actually is, we would all burn to toast. If we were any smaller than it actually is, we would assume a smaller orbit, which would mean more intense radiation, which means certain death. So our solar system is exactly as it needs to be. Our planet as well. We could only live on a planet that is the size of planet Earth. If it were bigger than it is, the increased gravity would hold on to poisonous gases like ammonia and methane and not sustain life. If it was any smaller than it is, the decreased gravity could not hold on to enough life gases like oxygen and water, so life could not exist. The Earth could also not sustain life, or could only sustain life at this distance from the sun. If we were any closer to the sun, we would experience runaway greenhouse effect. And if we were any farther, we would turn into otter pops in a very short period of time. So the Earth also is precisely right. In fact, we could go on and on about this, but there are hundreds of finely tuned features in the universe that science and scientists have discovered, all of which are absolutely necessary for life to have ever existed on this planet. What does this all mean? I want you guys to maybe think about what it takes to cause a car, a combustion engine, to work. There are certain things that are just absolutely necessary for the combustion engine to work so that you could even drive here to church tonight. Three things in particular every combustion engine needs. It needs fire, it needs air, and it needs fuel. Those three things are required for all of our cars: fire, air, and fuel. In addition to that, though, it needs all of the components that are going to bring these three things together. And so we have cylinders, we have pistons, we have batteries, we have fuel lines, we have air intake. All of these are different components that will bring together those three things. So in your gas tank is a compartment that holds all of the fuel, but then there is a line that is going to take that gas into the engine to deposit a small amount of that fuel into a cylinder with a piston. But in addition to that fuel, it also needs air. Because without air, that fuel would not ignite. But it needs something to ignite it as well. And so the battery is hooked up to cables that are then hooked up to a spark plug that offers up that small spark. And all three of these need to come together at the same time. The right amount of fuel, with the right amount of spark, with the right amount of air, so that a small explosion happens in that piston or in that cylinder that causes the piston to push out. In each of your cars, whether you have a four-cylinder, a six-cylinder, an eight-cylinder, some of you might have a three-cylinder, All of those pistons are causing the engine to run. But in addition to that, you need other components. You need things that are going to maintain a proper, healthy environment for that engine to function. For example, you need coolant, because all of that friction that is going on within that engine is causing a lot of heat. So the coolant system, including the radiator and the coolant within the radiator and the hoses that are going to take that coolant through the engine compartment, is going to keep that engine at a cool enough temperature for it to continue to operate. And the oil is going to keep the engine parts that are moving lubricated enough so that they don't seize. All of these different components are having to work together in order for the engine to operate. Now, nobody in their right mind is going to believe that the combustion engine created itself or just simply came into being over a very long period of time. We know by looking at all of those fine-tuned parts that every one of those parts is required for this system to work. So someone must have had to design it in order for it to ever happen, because it was not going to happen on its own. Nobody is going to pop the hood on their vehicle, lift that hood, look under that engine, and say, look what just happened. We know that a designer made it happen and brought it into being. And science knows it as well. Michio Kaku, who is a theoretical physicist, said this: "It's shocking to find out how many of the familiar constants of the universe lie within a very narrow band that makes life possible. If a single one of these accidents, emphasis mine, by the way, I want you to highlight that word accidents, were altered, stars would never form. The universe would fly apart. DNA would not exist. Life as we know it would be impossible." William Lane Craig went on to say this: "The preciseness of the universe is like firing a bullet towards the other side of the observable universe 20 billion light years away and nailing a one-inch target." Now, I want to contrast these two quotes here for a quick second, because the first quote by Michio Kaku is from a secular scientist, a theoretical physicist, who does not believe that God created the heavens and the earth. That's why he uses the word accidents in the middle of his quote. He basically is saying it is amazing that all of these accidents happened just like they happened, because if they didn't happen like they happened, life would not be possible. The second quote, though, by William Lane Craig, he's actually a Christian apologist, a believer in God, and instead of using the word accidents, he uses the word preciseness. Both of them are looking at the same evidence that we see in the universe. One calls them accidents, the other calls it preciseness. And really, that is the difference between what is happening within the secular scientific community and what is happening within the Christian community. It is not that they have their truths and we have our truths. We are looking at the same universe. It's just that one is saying, wow, this is pretty amazing that all of these accidents could happen in just this way. While others are looking at it and saying, look how precise God is and how he designed the universe to be. This undeniable design, guys, by the way, that we see in the universe was noted by a very famous atheist by the name of Antony Flew, who was one of the world-renowned disbelievers that there is a God. He was a full-blown atheist, but when he began to realize the intricacies that are in the universe, he renounced his atheism and became a believer in a creator. And he wrote a book about it, his journey from being an absolute atheist to believing that there's no way that this possibly could have happened on its own. That brings us to our third question, and that is this: how then did life first appear on the earth? Okay, so at some point, life started. Life did not start at the time that the heavens and the earth were created, because the heavens and the earth came first, but then life appeared. So we need to ask ourselves, how then did life appear? Scientists honestly don't agree on the where and the how. There are some that believe that the origin of life actually happened somewhere out in space. Others say, no, it actually happened in the water. Others say, no, it actually happened on land. But they don't agree, basically, because every one of those explanations, in the way that they explain it, has problems with it. The main problem is this, is that life cannot really come from non-life. And if there was a point in time when there was no life in the universe, and then life appeared, how then do we explain that that life appeared? Now, there was a time that many believed in something that was called spontaneous generation. That is the belief that life actually does come from non-life. They would point to certain things to show how that happens, like a piece of rotting meat would have maggots coming out of it. So they say, well, that meat's not alive, but look, the life is coming out of that non-life in the form of these maggots. Or they would look at flies that would be on a trash heap and say, look at the flies that are coming out of the non-life that is in this trash heap. Or they'd look at fleas that are coming out of a sand dune and they say, look, life is coming out of non-life. But in the 1800s, Louis Pasteur proved them all wrong by showing that it is not possible for life to come from non-life. What science did, though, find out is this, is that proteins are the building blocks of life. And that all living things are made out of proteins. And proteins are generated in little factories that are called ribosomes. I'm sure many of you guys have gone through this in high school biology or college biology. The thing is that ribosomes are made out of proteins themselves. So we've learned that all proteins are generated by ribosomes, but ribosomes are made out of proteins. It basically is what came first, the chicken or the egg. Because if ribosomes are made out of proteins, but all proteins come from ribosomes, you come up with a dilemma. You don't know which one came first. Were there proteins that created the ribosomes that then began to make proteins? And if that was the case, how did the proteins get created in the first place if there were no ribosomes? This is one of the scientific dilemmas. How can ribosomes evolve to make proteins if they themselves are made out of proteins? What this tells us, guys, is that everything had to be in place at the get-go. It could not evolve into having the capability to make these things if it needed those things to begin with. And such is the case with proteins. All of life is made out of proteins. Ribosomes make the proteins. Ribosomes are made out of proteins. So what came first? Science doesn't really have an answer to that, but we do. The Bible tells us in John chapter 1, verse 3, all things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that has been made. You see, if you believe that life came from natural causes, you have a real hard time explaining how that happened. And there have been scientific experiments that have tried to recreate creating life from non-life in the laboratory. They have not been able to do it. In fact, they haven't even been able to come close. That brings us to our fourth question, and that is this. How then do we also explain the inherent design that is in life forms? Getting back to the ribosomes, I want to also pose this. How do the ribosomes know how to make proteins? Well, we know the answer to that, actually. It's the DNA. DNA is what enables the ribosomes to make the proteins that's going to create life and carry on life. DNA, as you guys know, is the carrier of genetic information for all living things. And that strands of DNA have four different nucleotides, which make up basically our genetic code. So all of us are made up, our genetic code is made up of the DNA. It basically is giving instructions to the ribosomes on how to make the proteins that are necessary for life. All this information, guys, in the DNA requires an intelligent source. How do we know, though, that it requires an intelligent source? Why couldn't this just happen? There's a guy by the name of Werner Gitt who is an information technologies expert, and he developed what he called the five levels of information. Or I should say, didn't develop it, he introduced it in an understandable way, the five levels of information. That is that all information is communicated through code. We understand things and learn things through code that we are able to comprehend. And he put this on five different levels, and I want to walk you guys through these levels so that you have some understanding of what it is that he was trying to get across. The first level, the most base level of information, he called statistics. And this would be basically the equivalent of what would essentially give us our alphabet. Okay? So, level one, statistics, this would be our alphabet. Now, I put up on the board a series of letters that would be as if any one of us, randomly and without thought, decided we were going to type on a typewriter or on our keyboard. Not anything specific, just randomly. I mean, this could have been even, you know, your cat walking across your keyboard, punching the certain letters that came out in a pattern. You know, letters are essential for intelligent communication, right? But if you only have letters, but you don't have any code or understanding of how letters are put together, you might just have a string of letters like I have up there on the screen that don't make any sense whatsoever. For us, it doesn't really say anything at all. Of course, maybe you can pick out something that it says, like there's the word toe I can see. Say, okay, I recognize that. I see toe. But we could look at that and say, well, you know what? That could just happen by random chance. I mean, there's 26 letters in the alphabet. You know, you just randomly hit a bunch of letters without any intelligence behind it at all. Eventually, you're going to have some words that are going to pop up. There might be some other things that we have some understanding of. There's, like over here, there's BTW. We know that, by the way, right? Okay, it has some meaning for us, but that too, it could be absolutely random. That is the absolute base level of how information is passed. Now, level two takes it up a notch. Werner Gitt labeled this, level two, as the syntax level. It would be like linking letters together that actually form words that we recognize. So there would be recognizable pattern in the letters that form words, but not necessarily a clear message. Now here I've got, you know, four words. Jim Blue Spin Singing. Okay, we recognize those words because the letters are put in a pattern along with spaces that we can recognize, and we can read those. But that doesn't make any particular sense to us at all. It seems pretty random and doesn't really communicate anything specific to us. But you get to the third level, which he called semantics, and on that level, it is putting words together to communicate a message that we can understand, like this statement, water is wet. Now, that is something that we can understand. That is information that is communicated to us that now we get the message that is being sent. The fourth level the fourth level takes it a little further, which is what he called pragmatics. This is where it communicates a clear message that is also requesting a response, like the statement, shut the window. That not only is giving out information, it is an informative statement that is actually requiring or expecting a response. If I say, shut the window, you respond to that knowing that I have given you some information, something to do, and you might go to the window and decide to close it. And there was one final stage, and that is what he called apophatics, which is a clear message that expects a response, not just requests a response, but is expecting a response, which actually is showing purpose. So if I said, shut the window because it's raining outside, it is showing that there is a purpose why I am asking you to do what I'm asking you to do. So these five different levels of information are basically a hierarchy of information. So that level one is a very base level, which barely gives any information to us at all, but you get to level five and you're getting absolute information that is requiring a response and actually has purpose for what is being communicated. And what I'm telling you guys is this, is that DNA operates on the highest levels of information. The way that the DNA strand works in communicating to the ribosomes as well as the rest of the molecules in our body, it is what makes us what we are. And there's nothing random about it. It is very specific. So specific that Richard Dawkins, an evolutionary biologist, said, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. I want you to notice again how he words it. He is acknowledging of the appearance of design and the appearance of purpose, but he discounts it by saying that it is an appearance of design and purpose. It seems that the scientific community can see the design, but aren't willing to acknowledge that there is a designer behind it. Michael Denton, who is a biochemist, said this. He said that each constituent utilized by the cell for a particular biological role, each cog in the watch, turns out to be the only, and at the same time, the ideal candidate for its role, is apparently suggestive of design. Moreover, there is simply no way that such a prefabrication could be the result of natural selection. Guys, what I'm hoping that you're grabbing onto in what I'm sharing tonight is, you know, yeah, we did not delve into the fossil record or some of the things that came out of Darwin's Origin of the Species, because I purposely intended to take it back even further. Because if the universe is not eternal and nothing cannot make something, then something had to make the universe. That is God. And if the universe that we live in shows evidence of design that requires a designer, much like we would look at an engine in our cars and know that that just didn't happen by itself, then we come to the conclusion that the universe was designed by an intelligent being, and that is God. And that if life has come into existence, and life can't come from non-life, then God must have brought life into existence. And fourthly, if life itself shows so much design, down to our DNA being an elaborate code to tell life how to replicate itself and how to heal itself and how to duplicate itself, then there's design in that too. I want to finish by showing you guys a video. It's about 6 minutes long that hopefully is going to kind of bring all this around. And if you're listening to this message online, this is a video that you can watch yourself. You can just go to YouTube and look up DNA is code, who coded it, and you will find this video. I want to close with one last thought, and that is, if there is so much evidence for intelligent design, why is it that there's so much resistance to it? I don't want to assume that every person who rejects God or Christianity or the notion that there is a divine creator feels this way, but I do think that it's very common. I want to share with you guys a quote from Thomas Nagel, who's an American philosopher, but I think he was very honest in what he had to say. He said, "I want atheism to be true, and I'm made uneasy with the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't want to believe in God and naturally hope that I am right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that." And I don't think he's the only one that feels that way. I think a lot of people in the scientific community are looking at the same evidence that we just talked about tonight. But their thought process is they don't want to even give the possibility that there is a God who is out there, that has made the heavens and the earth. Because I think if they were honest with themselves, not that they would totally reject what it is that they think that is right, but that they would at least open their eyes to the possibility that there is a God who made all things. I'm hoping that tonight has been helpful to some of you guys that maybe have had questions. I will say this, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a person who is brilliant in physics or chemistry or biology. But I am a human being who has a brain. And I am able to look at the things that are made. And just like you and I could both look at a sand dune and a sand sculpture differently, or we can look at a canyon and Mount Rushmore and know that these two things did not happen in the same manner, we can look at our universe and see that there is design to the extent that there's no way in the world that this could have just happened. Father in heaven, I pray that you would speak to our hearts, that today, tonight, somehow would build us up in our understanding of what is going on in the world and why we live in a generation that seems to be so combative when it comes to a notion that there is a God who made the heavens and the earth. We pray, Lord, that we could wrestle through these things. If we have more questions, we would seek out those answers. And I pray, Lord, that you would lead us into all truth. Because, Lord, we know that not only are you the author of the Bible, you are the author of creation. And the message that creation is going to say to us will match the message that you speak through your word. Lord, let us hear that message, and it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.